we're back. Welcome once again to another episode of Mike, Mike, and Oscar. It's a new week. I am your co-host, Mike Wan. This is co-host also Mike.
Also Mike here. That's way too cheerful of an introduction.
Well, we've got to start on a high note because we're
watch
going
your tone.
Straight down. Yeah, we're doing an Oscar sprint profile today. We will give you again
ACDC's Highway to Hell should open this episode.
I think I might do that now. So yeah, we're doing an Oscar sprint profile for the movie First Reformed. This is, again, a notorious movie in MMO lore. You have had issues with it on air.
We've been talking some
the
trash
can down
about
the road
it.
A while.
I've been talking some real hardcore shit about it. And yet, I mean, my distaste for the characters is still there. I mentioned I had a begrudging respect for it. I now realize after four watches why I have such a respect for it. And that's where I land after all this. This is a very strong movie.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything that you just said right there. And we're going to get into the specifics of it and where the movie goes. And
but it's fucked up!
It certainly has its twists and turns. And as true Oscar sprint profile fashion, we were going to give you the non-spoiler review of this for the first half of this episode. And then obviously we'll have the big spoiler warning dance breakdown like we always do, followed by the spoiler-filled review. So if you have not seen the movie yet, do not fear. The first half of this is spoiler-free. And we will get into the cast and crew. Also, Mike always starts us off. So First Reformed, the Ethan Hawke, Cedric the Entertainer, Amanda Seyfried vehicle, written by and directed by Paul Schrader of Taxi Driver fame. Also, Mike.
Yes. Famed Martin Scorsese screenwriter, Paul Schrader.
Disciple?
Also,
do we call him a disciple of Scorsese?
He would not like that. Raging Bull. Paul Schrader didn't see a movie until the year 1920 of his life when he was a student, and he got away from his severe religious upbringing. He was so religious.
I did not know that.
His family was so religious. He, for his entire career, he essentially avoided movies about religion with the exception of The Last Temptation of Christ, which is antithetical in many ways, and I guess on the heretic fringe of religion there, Last Temptation of Christ. I never seen it, honestly. It's one of them I have to see, I guess. He's also written The Yakuza, The Mosquito Coast, City Hall, and Bringing Out the Dead. Schrader also has 23 director credits, and we were chatting before the show. Those are not quite as good as the writing credits, even though some of them, there's a cross-section between some of them. American Gigolo and Affliction are perhaps his two most notable directorial efforts.
Got a couple Oscar noms for stuff he's directed. Not himself, but the product.
Which is surprising, by the way, because Taxi Driver and Raging Bull not getting...
Right, yeah, and you get two acting nominations for Affliction and one win. So
that's why all this Oscar buzz has just been building and building and building.
It's his time,
for this guy.
It's his time, yeah.
To finally get a nomination.
Right.
Because you look at, I mean, those movies have aged extremely well. Mm-hmm. Taxi Driver and Raging Bull are classics. They're going to be, you know, canon for cinephiles, you know, 100 years from now.
Taxi Driver aging so well that they redid it this year with Joaquin Phoenix.
A little bit. Lately, he's gotten a lot of buzz. He's also got a lot of coverage for being like Taylor Swift's number one fan, Mike. He's on Twitter saying that. I mean, he's saying some over the top things about her being why he needs to live his life in general. I mean, look at those quotes. They're out there.
So he's like a hardcore T Swift
I wrote it down. She makes existence possible. She is the light that gives meaning to our lives.
He might have some obsessive qualities, you think?
A little bit. A lot of this is making sense.
Just replaced religion in his life with Taylor Swift, which is something a lot of people have done, as a matter of fact.
There's a Sean Fantasy podcast interview with Paul Schrader where his cigar-smoking voice is even lower than mine and Tom Hanks from the post
give
there.
Give it time.
And Paul Schrader talks about how he's dealt with alcoholism throughout his life. And after a Nicolas Cage movie that he did, and he thought his career was over. Basically, it's a fascinating story about how in the old days, he never pushed for Final Cut because he always felt that he was dealing with film people and he can have an argument and he can have a debate. And at the end of the day, everybody's trying to do what's best for the film. Even if he lost the debate or the argument and they had more power, bottom line is everybody's knows movies and they're trying to do what's best for the movie.
Sure.
In the Nicolas Cage movie, I think Dying of the Light was the name of it. It said you have to essentially have this many action scenes in this amount of time or we're not financing the project, or we're not giving it enough, or we're taking it away from you, essentially. And he didn't have enough action scenes in that amount of time, and they took the project away from him. And it was, he thought his career was over.
9% on the tomato meter, 35 critical reviews, 3 positive.
Yeah. Him and Cage reteamed back up again on another movie that wasn't great, Dog Eat Dog, but was something that people, you know, liked. It was an angry movie, and it finally, you know, gave him the courage to make this one, which was his entire life he always wanted to make a Ingmar Bergman type of film. And we have this kind of existential look at religion.
It's funny the parallels between filmmaking and pro wrestling. The press pro wrestlers are all these the characters that are just basically themselves turned up to 11. And we find a lot of times in filmmaking, the best pictures that these guys pen are usually basically biographical looks turned onto the page and the screen, turned up to an 11.
Yes, absolutely. Definitely indicative of his life. So, fascinating backstory to this one. Minus or because of the Taylor Swift stuff, I don't know. But that's definitely there, which is just weird. It's just kind of weird for an old man to be such a big Taylor Swift man. Am I the only one who senses that? Everybody's like looking at it like it's very cute online.
I mean, whatever. I like Taylor Swift. I don't care. Listen, State of Grace.
I know he's making jokes, but it's just a little creepy.
State of Grace is an underrated song, and I am not a Taylor Swift fan. I do not like her.
Yeah, I don't
that sings a banger, and I can understand being obsessed with it.
Okay. First Reform stars Ethan Hawke.
I knew you had trouble when I walked in.
Let's get the jokes out now. Yes, thank you. First Reform stars Ethan Hawke as the pastor of an old museum of a church owned by a much larger, massive congregation, Abundant Life Around the Corner. He's more of a custodian and tour guide than he is serious pastor. He has very few people that frequent the church on Sundays. Hawke's last 10 years as an actor included some big budget blockbusters like The Magnificent Seven and Valerian and the blah, blah, blah. He's also being in. Sorry.
Nice.
He's also been in some surprise mega hits, right? Like his blockbusters really didn't hit that hard.
The Purge.
The Purge was a small budget Blumhouse movie.
Mm-hmm.
Huge hit. Sinister.
Yeah.
You know, was a big hit, another horror movie. His indie film game is as strong as ever. Maudie, Maggie's Game, Predestination, The Phenom, Born to be Blue, performances that I've really liked over the past few years. He's also been in Oscar winners, Boyhood for Richard Linklater,
yep.
Training Day opposite Denzel, Dead Poets Society when he was a kid, playing a student of Robin Williams there.
Also and, been in a lot of movies that don't age well, according to Mike and Oscar.
Yes. And of course, he's perhaps best known for his role as Jesse in the Before series for Linklater there. I love that series.
Yeah, Before Midnight, Before Paris, Before Sunrise, Before Thursday.
That's the next one
coming
yeah.
out, yeah.
Yeah, good job. Good joke.
That takes place on a Wednesday.
Yes, it would. Cedric Kyles, a.k.a. Cedric the Entertainer, plays Jeffers, pastor of Abundant Life.
He's great in this.
Oh, his performance is awesome.
He really is.
His character is like a 1980s teenage movie parent. Coming-of-age movie parent.
Okay, and I didn't get that, but yeah, I can see it.
He's like always preaching, but the kids just can't relate.
Yeah,
and
all right.
That's Ethan Hawke just can't relate to him, even though they're all saying smart things.
How do we reach these kids?
Ethan Hawke tries to tell him what's wrong. It doesn't really happen, but yes, damn good performance. Fordham grad. Amanda Seyfried plays Mary. She's a pregnant wife to a man suffering from severe depression, who Ethan Hawke is asked to minister to. Seyfried has been in Mamma Mia films past 10 years.
She has won me over so hard. I never used to, like, when she first got on the scene, I always thought she was overacting, but man, is she
Well, Letters
a
to Juliet.
Yeah, that's true. That's actually a really, that's
one
probably
of your
where
most,
it comes from.
I know you now. I know you a little bit now, and you have biases.
I was forced to
sit you hold grudges. You
yes.
do hold grudges.
Yes, and so I was never a fan, probably strictly and only because of Letters to Juliet. But
it
man, is she
you.
A talent. She is unbelievable.
But Twin Peaks is something you've liked recently. She was in that.
Great. She was great in that. She's awesome in this as well. The supporting cast, all the performances in this one are really well
yes.
done.
Ted 2, Les Miserables, Big Love, and of course, Letters to Juliet, or elsewhere on her filmography there, being deceived free. Mary's husband, Michael's played by Philip Ettinger, whose performance I'm thoroughly
yep.
impressed with.
Another great one. Yeah, absolutely.
He's known for roles in Compliance and Indignation. So this actor doesn't shy away from absurdly intense roles. Those other two movies are super intense as well. Victoria Hill plays Esther, choir director at Abundant Life, has a relationship with Ethan Hawke, his one true friend in many ways. And Michael Gaston plays energy company CEO Balk. That's all his name is.
They should have just stopped beating around the bush and just called him Dick.
Yeah. Some story inception production notes, not a ton, but filmed in 20 days in Brooklyn and Queens, New York.
20 days, man.
It did a large loop at the film festivals this past winter and early spring. Paul Schrader makes some serious pronouncements on the movie industry during that loop. He says anybody can make a film, but nobody can make any money on films anymore. Which is a wrong statement because these movies are making more money anyway.
I mean, it's an interesting statement because
he's not making money on
right.
films.
The most money is going to the big blockbusters, and that's kind of the origin of the whole argument that The Ringer laid out that we always comment on about
Blumhouse
how cinema
is making
dead.
Big money on
but
small.
Of course, there are the smaller studios that are films. Still turning out and doing their best. So it's an argument.
It's an argument. Some people are not making money on films. I get it. So he says TV is making a ton of money, and Netflix and Amazon Prime rejected his movie, so he had a lot of shit to talk about kind of TV making money there. It's kind of hard to listen to, honestly. There's, again, this is a lot of grudges there.
Colin Jost made a joke during the Emmys opening about how he had a script rejected from Netflix, which is spending $8 billion on original programming.
Oh.
And he said, so that really made me feel awful.
We haven't submitted anything there yet, but I'm sure when they reject us, we'll feel the same way. So I relate. I relate to Paul Schrader. You hold grudges. I hold grudges. I won't pretend to think and
we
do otherwise.
We all hold grudges together.
We're very combative. Yes. Schrader talked about his influences on this story being Bresson's Diary of a Country Priest, Ingmar Bergman's Winter Light, and Carl Theodor Dreyer's Odette. I've seen one out of the three of those.
Over I don't, three for me.
After watching this, I don't know if I'm going to seek them out next week or so. We'll see. We review too many current movies, though. It's kind of hard. He's surprised how much of Taxi Driver is in here. He didn't do it consciously, he says, Paul Schrader, but there's a lot of Taxi Driver parallels that critics have made to this story, and he does agree, and he basically says that the final product is much closer to that story than he ever thought would have happened.
It definitely is a Crusade-type movie.
Right.
Yeah. Let's do some specs for this movie here. First Reformed, written and directed by Paul Schrader, also Mike Tolger, writer of Raging Bull and Taxi Driver, a director of American Gigolo and Affliction. This film actually debuted at the film festival in Venice in 2017, so about exactly a year ago, but didn't come stateside until May 18th of this year. So it had its international debut. A24, which is the distribution company, bought its rights, held on to it. Got rid of it this year, so this is when it's up for these Oscars and not last year's.
Makes sense in many ways.
113-minute runtime on an R rating, produced by Killer Films, Omira Studios Partners, Fibonacci Films. Wasn't there a Fibonacci who was a bad guy in a TV show?
Sure.
That's what bothered me. All right. ArcLight Films and Big Indie Productions.
Googling now for you, sir.
Distributed, like I said, by A24. The budget was really a shoestring. It was made for a paltry $3.5 million, according to Wikipedia. And Box Office Mojo has it as having done just shy of that number after its theatrical run domestically. It brought in $3.44 million with no international release as of yet. It's curious to me, since, again, it debuted internationally almost exactly a year ago, but needless to say, there haven't been many eyes that have taken the dive into this film yet, but the ones that have seem to say they've gotten their money's worth at least out of it.
So the critics love it, and yet the audiences haven't seen it yet. And by the way, Fibonacci is a mathematician. I just Googled that.
Now, there was a bad guy in a TV show, I'm pretty sure, named Fibonacci.
Okay.
7.2 IMDb rating on 11,000 plus votes. Certified Fresh Rotten Tomato 93% on 187 critic scores, 173 of those being positive. The average critic score is at 8.3 out of 10, very high. And among 35 top Rotten Tomatoes critics, that number gets even more absurd as 34 reviews of those are positive, giving it a 97% score with an average of 8.6 out of 10 amongst top RT critics. Regular audiences, though, on Rotten Tomato are much more aligned with the IMDb users, which is probably probably an unsurprising fact to learn, as it garnered an audience score of 68% on 2,154 votes thus far.
I get that.
average audience score of 3.5 out of 5. Interesting to note that in terms of Rotten Tomato scores, this is the highest rated film Schrader has worked on since the other two Scorsese classics mentioned previously, Raging Bull and Taxi Driver. So he is getting a lot of love critically.
And I also get that. We're going to talk about it.
The Metascore is the capper here. It's an 85 Metascore and 47 critical reviews, including 10 perfect scores of a 100, 27 total reviews of an 88 or higher, 8 total reviews of a 70 or lower, including the low man on the totem pole being Mike Scott from the New Orleans Times-Picayune, who gave it a 40.
Again, I can see all reactions to this movie. I really
could. I'm with you. It's easy to...
Yes.
It's... polarizing.
Very, very true. I can see why they held it, you know, after last year's Venice and last year's Green Drop. I can see why they kind of, you know, figured they would just release it slowly, but it never really picked up, which is why I'm surprised we're reviewing it today, which is why we didn't review it back when. Because I was like, nobody's seen this movie
came out. And still had, it had like, I think, 11 weeks in theaters. The most theaters it touched, I think, was 300, so it hasn't even
Films typically don't, they're blips on the radar, they don't get nominated at the end of the day, but this one still got a lot of strong support. The plot premise reads, a priest of a small congregation in upstate New York grapples with mounting despair brought on by tragedy, worldly concerns, and a tormented past. Michael, you buying everybody in your family tickets to see that movie?
That's like the most accurate IMDb synopsis that we've had, I think, for any movie we've reviewed. That hits on all the A, B, C, D storylines.
So, all right, let's get into our expectations, teaser review, theater-going experience here. I showed up at a 10 p.m. screening back in May in Fairfield, Connecticut, and I was the only person in the theater. I watched this myself. I left this film in disgust.
Yeah, I bet.
Utter disgust. Angry. I got to thinking about it after a while, and I kind of raised the grade in my little Google documents there after
you had visceral anger towards this, towards not only the movie, but its momentum, how it was so embraced by the critical audience.
It dropped on video, VOD there. I've watched it three more times, and I'm breaking it down, and as a film critic watching this, I have more than just begrudging respect. I have adoration for what he's doing here, and I think it's an important movie in many ways at the end of the day, and it does emote a serious reaction from us.
Oh, yeah. My expectations were probably similar. I was expecting something sad. I was expecting, anytime you have a priest in a lead in this day and age, I don't know if it's because of what's going on in the Catholic Church, and has been for years now with the scandals. I don't know if it's because Spotlight just won Best Picture a couple years ago, and that's what we're just going to assume from now on. But any priest movie you assume is about pedophilia. When that's just how I react, and that's not a good feeling to have. But so I was kind of happy that that wasn't the case.
Just
but still,
the largest settlement ever just this past weekend for Catholic Church.
Four cases. It was like $28 million or something like that. Yeah. Disgusting. Anyway, so yes, that's my mindset with current events and stuff. That's what I was expecting. I was kind of pleasantly surprised to see it wasn't bad, even though it was still some dark territory. I was expecting Ethan Hawke to be the best part of this movie, and for me, he wasn't.
Perfect. But Oscar lens, let's do it right off the bat here.
All
right,
so let's start with the Oscar lens. The shining star of this movie to me is Paul Schrader's script.
I would agree that the best original screenplay probably has the best chance of everything. I'm rewatching this movie, I can appreciate Ethan Hawke's performance all the more because it's very subtle. And just the makeup, or the lack of makeup, with his all furrowed brow. The furrowed brow is the star of this movie. I'm just watching the lighting on his forehead and all the lines. It's almost like he's got a cross on his forehead. Just shows how weathered he is. And when he's in the big lights of the congregation at Abundant Life, and he's listening to the choir, which his friend and former lover, I guess, is, you know, conducting there. It just looks like he is a statue of an old Christian monk or something.
His character's been through the ringer, and the exposition of that is brought up well in the beginning conversations early in the film that he has with the Michael character. I still, though, the momentum for this movie was all about Ethan Hawke. A lot of people had Ethan Hawke at the tops of their list for Best Actor. They thought he was a shoo-in for a nomination.
I have some numbers for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
So the numbers for Ethan Hawke here. Next Best Picture has 6 out of 10 of their critics 2 weeks ago when we were about to review it. Now it's 7 out of 10 of their critics have Ethan Hawke in their top 10s for Best Actor. A lot of those are top 5s. Yeah. Award Circuit, I should have wrote down the top 5s. Award Circuit has him 16th in the Best Actor conversation.
That's where I am. I'm not...
Gold Derby has, now this is the kicker here. Gold Derby had 6 out of 16 in the top 5 2 weeks ago. Now it's 6 out of 20. So there's the holdouts, you know, the critics that are holdouts and the pundits that are holdouts.
Anytime you do release a movie worth consideration, Oscar consideration earlier in the year, you're going to have the early excitement, they're going to be ranked high, then you hit the lull, and then you really get the sense of how it's going to hold up towards the end of the year when the winter months come, if there's that re-push or the redistribution or it gets written about again, as Get Out did last year was the big shining example.
To me, a movie like this, for it to really to get momentum again, needs a huge campaign behind it. This is just not that movie that's going to bring people in to watch it. And it's, unless people love Ethan Hawke out there and he's just the darling of the industry. Look, and he gets those brownie points, I don't see this, because this is like Phantom Thread appeal, but so much worse and so much far on the other end of the spectrum of deeply disturbing and sad.
It's more niche than the picture about the self-deprecating seamstress.
Right.
Yeah, so right. Yeah, I would agree with that. But here's where I fall on the Oscar lens of it all for Ethan Hawke anyway. I know this is unfair and it's just ridiculous, but this is where my mind immediately went.
Well, no, let's do it.
Toni Collette is by far to me the leader in the clubhouse for Best Actress. The fact that there is legitimate competition for her on that side, and there is, and we just talked about in our last episode how Scott Feinberg has her, you know, not even in his top 5. Right. So there's a legitimate race. Her performance is so much beyond what Ethan Hawke did for me in this one. And Ethan Hawke was great. I say, everyone in this was great. The leading characters' performances are all magnificent. I just don't think they're the Oscar-caliber level. And if Toni Collette and what she did in Hereditary can have competition, legitimate competition, I just think it was so far beyond what Ethan Hawke did. I don't think there's a way I could put him in my top 5. Even with so many big movies to come.
Here's the thing. Like, right now, Ethan Hawke's in my top 5. Right now.
Right now.
Based on what I've seen
thus far.
Probably
what I would say, too, but I don't expect it to be there. Yeah.
The top 5 best actresses I have, with Charlize Theron, Elsie Fisher. Mm-hmm. I had Glenn Close last night. And, of course, Toni Collette. I mean, those are every year in, year out, Oscar-worthy performances, in my opinion. And the level of the best actress performances versus the level of the best actor performances right now, there's no comparison.
I agree.
Like, Toni Collette's performance being an all-time horror movie performance is way... If I put a number on it, I would be 90s for that one, and this one is low 80s maybe. So
That's probably fair, yeah. Or high 70s for me.
Even still, those scenes with Cedric the Entertainer, Cedric Kyle's there, just blow my mind upon rewatch. And all his contortions, and it's so slight. Like, the smiles he gives are perfectly faked. And when he lets his hair down a little bit, and as the movie goes along, as he lets his hair down quite a bit more, he completely unravels, and the mannerisms get much bigger. But he's just such a combustible character, and he's such a powder keg early on. And I'm fascinated by the depiction Ethan Hawke is giving, because he's so uptight about it all.
Yeah, I'm not going to begrudge anyone for saying he's a top 5 right now.
Right.
As a matter of fact, right now, I probably would have him in the top 5, even though it would be probably 4th or 5th.
He's like, I'm Lakeith Stanfield or him for my number 1. It's hard. Yeah, right now. Sorry to bother you. And I don't think either of those guys are going to get it at the end of the day. I think a lot of best actor performances are still to come. I
agree with that as well. But to me, again, the reason that his performance was able to shine so brightly, the reason the performance of all these characters was able to shine so brightly, was one, the casting, which should be a new Oscar category, by the way. Casting and stunt should absolutely be. But two, the script to me. I mean, the nuance and the subtlety in the script and the layers it pulls off. The reason Mike Scott gave it that 40 that we talked about, the New Orleans Times-Picayune critic there.
Yep.
The reason he gave it a 40 was because he said doesn't really, essentially the movie doesn't have, it hints at a lot of principles, but it doesn't have one overarching theme to bring them all in. I don't think that's a bad criticism.
I disagree, though. I think there is one very obvious theme we'll talk about in spoilers.
And it might be anarchy or something like that.
I
got something else. Okay,
I feel like
fine.
I got it. I
that's
got
fine.
It pegged finally. So, it took me forever. Well, you want me to give you the numbers on original screenplay?
Yeah, tell
first?
Me how everyone else is feeling.
So, Gold Derby, I'll start backwards this time. 8 out of 12 had it in their top fives 2 weeks ago. Now there's 18 pundits weighing in and 11 out of 18 after the festivals. Award Circuit does not have it in their top 40. So, Award Circuit, the critics over there, the guys we like, they really do not feel this movie is going to play. Next Best Picture, all 10 of their critics have it in their top 10 for Best Original Screenplay.
For Award Circuit to not have it in their top 40 after we've said how weak original screenplay looks this year is kind of surprising, though.
That is surprising. They just much viscerally hate it. Maybe that 40 is something that one of their critics would have had, too, or maybe their critics had a 50 in there. In terms of Best Picture, there's actually some... you know, slight buzz there. 2 weeks ago, 3 out of 16 pundits had it in their top 10 for Best Picture at Gold Derby. Now only 1 out of 20.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like it's dying a slow death.
Again, Award Circuit doesn't like it. It's not in their top 50 for Best Picture. It's still not there. It's never been in Next Best Picture's top 10s either. But Gold Derby, major pundits.
Yeah.
Have it in their top 10s.
So there's momentum. I mean, there is. This does exist in a world where it could win some Oscars, and that's fine. For me, again, Schrader's script, the things he's able to comment on without actually commenting on them, the subtext that he brings to this is just fascinating.
I think at the end of the day, there's a lot of distaste for the characters in this movie and what they do. And it's very human. It's very understandable when you look at the overall.
Very human is
affected,
what I would say, yeah.
It's affected by what the forces they're dealing with. And it's mental illness, and it's alcoholism,
and
substance abuse.
And it makes people take a look in the mirror.
So it's very heavy. And when you're dealing with issues that are so strong and that are wreaking havoc in our society, and you throw on this whole spiritual angle to it of despair and depression and trauma in terms of a tormented past like the premise hinted at, and you have a just perfect storm going on. So that's, again, when you show characters behaving badly and despicably, I don't think that means the movie is pushing those views or pushing those actions, pushing those morals, but it's showing you in many ways the derivation of those results. And just because a character acts poorly doesn't mean the movie is wrong or that the director is pushing that, is what I'm saying. And I think people, I'm not saying every, I think when we see characters do the things they do in this movie, we're like, ugh, just disgusted over it. But that doesn't mean it's a bad movie. In fact, I think the screenplay is extremely well constructed. It's just so distasteful.
No, I think there would be less outrage or less moral outrage about something like this than there was about Three Billboards last year, you know, which was criticized for praising racist views and different issues like that. So
I think this is a total cautionary tale in so many ways, and it shines light on the pitfalls of organized religion. And
I have a big comparison to make. For me, it's not organized religion. I know that's the take you take, but for me, it's for the people that use religion as a motivating factor or as a shield or however the simile you want to finish, but I'll get into it in spoilers.
Sounds good. Production values, we don't have a lot to say on these. In interviews and podcasts, Schrader mentioned that as a director, he was very restrained. He did not move the camera, bottom line.
You can see that.
And his instincts in every scene basically told him, move the camera, be Scorsese, right? Be the guy that I've worked with for 40 years and be more like him as a director. And he just said, all right, I can't do that in these scenes. So I had to totally use the foreground and the background of the frame and eye catch where I could and focus the camera on certain imagery and basically allow the audience to figure things out rather than be more manipulative with the medium here.
There's some beautiful shots, some static shots, just taking in the natural foliage and the natural skyline in the background. There's a beautiful sunrise shot with Ethan Hunt plastered against the background there.
Or Ethan Hawke.
Yeah, what him too. Mission Impossible. Ethan Hawke plastered against the background there. There's a beautiful shot of the church and just how minimalist it is in this like New England-ish type fall stuff. The cinematography for me is underrated and
right.
Well,
there's no Oscar lens on this necessarily, but production design, cinematography, I would argue, is very, very strong.
Yeah, yeah, agree. And the score for this as well is used more as a mechanism of manipulation than it is for...
Correct. The music is intense, and the music really works on your nerves. In terms of the performances, we mentioned Ethan Hawke. I want to say again, Cedric the Entertainer is an Oscar-level version of a John Hughes 80s movie parent, and I think that I'd probably stick to that.
He was great. Amanda Seyfried was great. In the Michael character was great.
The Edinger guy. Yeah. And Victoria Hill is, she's played just these total bombshells in her whole filmography. Like, she is a beautiful woman, and she is a little shrew of a choir director in this story. And it's
she's all that at her.
I looked, glasses
put
in
her
a ponytail.
Hair up and put glasses.
That scene with her and Ethan Hunt just broke my heart, tore it asunder.
Ethan Hawke?
Ethan Hunt. And then the one with Ethan Hawke was really emotional,
too. See, it's not so
easy,
is it?
It was really emotional, too.
What we're saying is watch Mission Impossible.
So any thoughts on the script, non-spoiler-wise, Mike? We mentioned how it's Oscar-worthy in our minds, but we had to be dragged kicking and screaming into this review because it's so intense.
It's ambiguous. The lesson, I think, the fact from this podcast alone, how we kind of have two very different meanings and deep-seated meanings from what we saw is indicative of kind of how it's a draw-your-own-conclusion type script. Which...
Yeah, it's one that I want to tell people to beware of, and I think we've alluded to enough of it, because this film, again, it talks about mental illness, depression, despair, existential crisis. Those are the kind of results of the plot, but there's also all kinds of societal issues that it's talking about, global warming, etc., you know, in the environment and in the corruption of the business world.
For sure.
I mean, it's showing up in a congregation, a church that's
like
a business.
You're not really expecting that. It's certainly not what you're set up for in the first half of the movie.
So let me nerd out here. A quote from Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings kept coming to mind.
Christ.
Quote, "It is perilous to study too deeply the arts of the enemy, for good or for ill, Michael." Gandalf didn't say you should completely avoid to study these subjects. He didn't say that it's something you should never do. He's just said it's perilous. It's dangerous. And I feel like I just went into such a funk after rewatching this movie 2 weeks ago, before the festivals, before we kept... You wanted to keep putting it on the back burner.
Yes.
I gladly agreed in many cases. And then I was like, screw it. We got to finally do it. But I was just like, this movie put me in a funk. I just was in such a bad way after studying this movie multiple times. And here we are. I think we're going to flush out a lot of the good that it's doing, but it's doing it in a way that by breaking down these subjects, it could be dangerous if you're in a bad mood. We always think that we always mention that, if you have serious issues with depression, you know, seek professional help.
Don't watch this. And also that Gandalf quote is why I only watch Fox News for 10 minutes at a time. Are you ready to dance?
Yeah, dude, can you like slow down the dance music in this episode and do something with it and just like make it?
I'm just gonna have just a woman crying silent for 40 seconds.
Spoilers. Dun, 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 dun.
We'll see you guys on the other side. Spoilers ahead.
This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Mike and Oscar, Oscar Sprint, spoilers!
This is the spoiler section for First Reformed. If you have not seen the movie yet, or you do not want to know what happens or why it is so sad that we moped about for the first half of this episode,
we did mope a little bit.
Hit stop here and go back, watch the movie, or read up on it, and then come back and hit play. If you do not mind being spoiled, you want to hear what happens and all the twists and turns, that you're in the right place, because that's all we're going to talk about from here on out. So here we are, the spoiler section of First Reformed. Michael, what do we have for carryovers to start?
That ending is really not a carryover, because we just alluded to the, you know, depth of despair at the end of it. But I think I just want to take the spoiler section and focus on the ending pretty much.
Let's set the table how we get there first. So Ethan Hawke is this reverend. We find out through exposition he has a congregation member, Mary, that's the Amanda Seyfried character, comes to him at the very beginning of the movie, says, "Hey, can you talk to my husband?"
My husband won't leave the house. He's an environmentalist, and he's super depressed. Yes.
So yeah. We find out through Ethan Hawke agrees to counsel the husband. He has conversation with Michael.
Now, Ethan Hawke is journaling these horrific things in there early in the film. Yes. He's like a monk in Christ in the Garden, as Cedric the Entertainer says. You're always in the garden, because he's despairing over life itself. He's got trauma in his past. And the things he's writing in his journal are fucked up.
Yeah.
From the jump. And he's not the guy to minister to this kid.
He has lived a life already of sadness. He lost a child. He encouraged his child to go join the military. He lost his child to war. That led to a divorce between he and his wife. And he finds himself, he thinks he's saved by becoming a reverend of this small church.
He has
First Reformed Church.
He has a relationship with the choir director of the church that owns the First Reformed Church,
which is Abundant Life, which is what Cedric the Entertainer runs. Mm-hmm. Basically, First Reformed, the smaller church, is being underwritten by this Balk company, who is this big, you know, every big conglomerate corporation ever that is polluting the land. Michael himself, being an environmental activist, had a big
scene at the diner, by the way.
Yeah.
Wow,
disgusting. Had a big problem with it. So when Ethan Hawke is trying to console and counsel Michael brings up the question of, can God ever forgive us? And that kind of becomes Ethan Hawke's character's mantra throughout the whole world, is that, can God ever forgive us for what man has done and society has done to his planet and his greatest creation of Earth? It's a very naturistic, a very pollution-heavy, environmental, global warming-heavy type ideal. Mm-hmm. Michael eventually kills himself. He blows his head off with a shotgun, a very gruesome scene. You don't see the kill itself, but you see Ethan Hawke finding the headless body.
So the crazy thing is, we think that Ethan Hawke ministers to Michael, right? When in fact, Michael's neuroses and despair and depression infects Ethan Hawke's character all the more, especially the way in which he relates the arguments about the environment and those who are dedicated to saving it to the martyrs of the Christian church.
Yes.
Which is something that throughout time in memoriam here, it's enabled some of the worst actions of the church, I would say. The persecution,
or those that
justified,
think yeah.
Yeah, throughout for centuries, you know, the persecution complex, which was grounded in historical truth, did not create a Mr. Rogers Christianity out of that.
Right.
It created a very militaristic Spanish Inquisitioning Christian church, which is oppressed as much as it has embraced society and the worst of society over the centuries.
Yeah.
That's facts. I mean, if you studied history, those are facts. I mean, the church is as human an entity as anything, and I stand by that. It's as human an entity as Microsoft and Apple. Yeah.
That is a big theme of this movie as well, the humanity and the right and wrong way that religion can guide you. But that finding Michael's headless body is kind of the big turning point, not only for Ethan Hawke's character, but for the movie in general. Ethan Hawke is then left to basically console and counsel and help Michael's widow now, Amanda Seyfried, who is left with child. She is pregnant, and Michael knew about that to begin with. That's kind of what led to his depression. To kind of bring her and help her get through this trying time, even though he himself, Ethan Hawke, is not really to have the tools to guide himself through this trying time. So eventually it leads to this Balk company, this evil corporation, this conglomerate, is getting ready for First Reformed's 250th reconsecration ceremony.
And again, it's a perfect storm with Ethan Hawke's character basically realizing that he has cancer, They didn't come up with the official diagnosis yet, but he's pissing blood. He's going to the doctor finally after being, you know, his one friend, the choir director, basically pushing him to go. And he goes to a doctor, and the doctor's like, "All right, listen, these are cancer treatments. This is probably right. What's happening. Come back for more tests. This is, you know, stop drinking alcohol. Cut it out of your life," because he's a raging alcoholic up to them. And he's journaling like Christ in the garden again, like a total lunatic. And it's masked in all this religious speak, but it's really just every word of it is a freaking cry for help.
Yes, and he actually gets addressed directly by Cedric the Entertainer at one point that you need help, so it's not like he's hiding it well.
So Cedric the Entertainer is kind of an enabler, and he's some of the worst colleagues in terms of his attentions, because it makes sense. He's got this whole congregation to look after. He's spread super thin, but he does know about the alcoholism. Cedric,
yep.
Kyles, the character. He does know that Ethan Hawke is flying off the handle at diners with patrons. He does know that Ethan Hawke is conducting services with left-wing environmentalist groups, which is a bad look for his brand. He right. does know that Ethan Hawke is going to youth groups and arguing with teenagers. He does know these things. He could very easily probably find out that the relationship he had with the choir director has worse than soured. I mean, I'm sure she talks to him, or somebody can talk to him. So he's not plugged in, Cedric Kyles, the Reverend character, to exactly the level of Ethan Hawke's nightmare that he's going through. And that is, if it's not neglect, it's certainly something that enables Ethan Hawke to downward spiral.
Michael's funeral, he left a will and testament to Ethan Hawke, and he wanted his ashes to be spread across this toxic waste dump, which is basically an arm of the Balk Corporation. And they had his environmentalist group there, and the church choir sang a Neil Young protest song.
Right.
As was in his will and testament. And so, basically, Ethan Hawke's defense is that I was just following this man's last wishes. I was just doing my job as a reverend, trying to get, you know, be holy and provide for his widow and help them through everything. The Balk Corporation, the man Balk himself, who becomes the main character in this storyline, kind of needles him in the scene at the diner where it's Balk, Cedric the Entertainer, and
beats Ethan him in an Hawke. Argument. Yeah. Literally an argument.
And basically
in front of his boss.
Rubs salt in his wound of saying, "Hey, didn't this guy kill himself only after you started counseling him? Right. Why don't you take a look at yourself before you start worrying about other people?"
So did you talk about the vest yet? So essentially the vest with Amanda Seyfried's character, she finds a suicide vest.
Yes.
From the husband Ettinger's character. He didn't use it, he killed himself instead, which foreshadows what happens at the very end here. And basically, she gives it to Ethan Hawke to destroy, to get rid of him. He's an ex-military man, like his father before him, like his son after him.
Yep.
So he figures that he can, you know, he can deal with it and let it not go to the authorities. And he admits that let's not bring disrepute on his cause.
She doesn't want the authorities
his
involved.
His cause is just.
So he does, he takes his suicide vest, his bomb vest, and it turns after Michael's suicide and after that interaction with Balk, it kind of turns into this cause. He starts losing himself into Michael's cause of the environment, starts taking it up, starts seeing Balk for this evil corporation instead of just an entity on Earth.
Wallows in all the same despair.
Yep. Gets the cancer diagnosis, gets the alcoholism, refuses to stop drinking. Actually makes a comment about how freeing he felt because he finally had decided in his head at that time that he was done with all of it.
And then he moves away from his real friend, the love she's trying to give him, the yep. choir director character there. And in that scene that just breaks your heart, he goes, you wrote it down, didn't you?
Yeah, the quote he gives you, "Esther, I despise you. I despise what you bring out in me. Your concerns are petty. You are a stumbling block." Now, that's done for a couple reasons. One, he thinks he's at rock bottom. He doesn't worry about anyone else's love or inclusion. He doesn't care anymore.
Two, he's white fanging her.
Yes.
Just getting her
yes.
to get go the hell into away the woods. From me. Get the hell away from me. I am self-destructing.
Exactly. And self-destructing to the most literal sense, because his big plan is on the 250th anniversary, the reconsecration ceremony, all these hundreds of people are going to be in First Reform, including the Balk character. Yeah. He plans on donning the suicide vest that he had from Michael and blowing them up, blowing up the church, killing many people, because he thinks it's going to do more good than harm in terms of stopping the head guy at Balk, who is doing this much harm to God's creation.
Right, as a way of protest for the environment. So
now, let's talk about how the film actually finishes, which is the finale you want to concentrate on.
Amanda Seyfried shows up. Now, that relationship has been building. They had the Magical Mystery Tour where this is just thoroughly inappropriate in my mind. And again, I think it's indicative of the Christian church where he is essentially a therapist, right? A counselor, a psychologist. You cannot, under any circumstance, with a recent widowed woman, have a physical relationship with that pregnant, vulnerable, again, mourning woman.
Unless you make
woman.
The conscious decision that you're done with being restricted. I mean, he says, one of his quotes is, why do we deprive ourselves? And that's after he's made the decision
so
in his
mind to be done. We reject
these
simple pleasures, right? We reject these simple pleasures. Again, it's totally, you know.
It is. It's vastly
heretical
for many of the
totally
church.
Heretical.
Absolutely.
And it just against, never mind the code of the religion, it's against the code of a therapist, of a counselor, of somebody in an authority position with a power dynamic of where you're ministering to somebody. There's, and Amanda Seyfried asking him to do this, or I think he like pushes it in. Do you want me to do this for you?
I don't remember.
Yeah, no,
I don't
he does. He does. Okay, so fine. It's his suggestion. And then he denies it, and then he says, okay, let's do it. And it's thoroughly inappropriate, and it's more intimate, like
so
a foot massage in
Pulp
Fiction.
So this Magical Mystery Tour, if you don't know, is literally him lying on his back on the ground. She lies literally on top of him,
they
so
touch
they're nose
as
to
much
nose.
As possible. It's just, again, thoroughly inappropriate. You don't do that. You don't reach that level of intimacy.
Now, ethically, But cinematically, it was beautiful.
It was beautiful, but it, you know, again, if anybody has theories that this is a kind of Taxi Driver character where he's got this righteousness about him at this stage of the film, character's doing despicable things, and this is his worst sin, in my opinion. So he is just completely just abusing this relationship, in my opinion. And again, doesn't disqualify the script as being bad, but I don't necessarily believe a tragedy gets to becoming a tragedy unless the character commits those sins. I mean, a horror movie, same thing. I mean, your lead characters commit unforgivable sins that they pay a penance for at the end of the story, and this is that for me.
So that happens, and again, we're taken through this journey, and it's not a very special effects driven movie, but this one scene was, I think, green screened or whatever, because we do see these two characters lying on top of one another. They're not kissing, they're not fornicating or anything.
You can tell it's in his mind because it goes throughout, you know, nature, and it's really nice, and it's, and again, it's a montage that is really beautiful, and then it turns into a montage of
pollution,
the world
darkness,
dying.
Despair. Yes. So again, he wants to don this vest to blow up this church at this consecration ceremony, and he tells Amanda Seyfried, that Mary character, hey, don't come. I don't want you there at that ceremony because she is in the dark as to his intentions, and he knows he's going to kill himself. He starts getting ready the day of this consecration ceremony. The church is packed. They're waiting for him to come in. He has his robe on, but under his robe is that suicide vest. As he's walking out the door, he notices Mary approaching the church. So she does attend the ceremony, again, just as a thank you, because of all the characters in this movie, she, I think, is the most pure. I mean, she has her faults, but she's the most ethical.
True. I mean, there's two loving characters in this story that are just essentially that they have. Well, I mean, they have their. I don't know. They're not round. She's not a rounded character. Let me say that.
No, she's one note.
I think she's one note. And the same thing with the choir director. Even though you get some more from her character based on her reactions and how she's trying
but
to
cling to
him.
But my point is there's no sinister background. There's no deviousness in Mary showing up. She's literally there just as a sign of support.
Right.
So he sees that. Ethan Hawke sees that. And he loses his mind in his sanctuary.
Literally.
Yeah. He starts now. This is the end.
So now he found when another ominous omen, let's say, the day before he found barbed wire out on one of the gravestones that he tends a cemetery next to the old church, dead rabbit caught in the barbed wire. And he's not all that sad about it, but he brings the barbed wire into the church. So he has barbed wire. They make a big point of showing that to us.
So takes off the suicide vest. Can't blow up the church with Mary in there. She doesn't deserve this ending. He decides for himself.
Right.
Because he is now playing God instead of just following what he thinks is following God. Yep. Takes off the suicide vest, takes off his robes. He's going to wrap himself in barbed wire.
He does, panting like a lunatic. It's disgusting.
He thinks he pours himself a literal glass of WD-40 motor oil.
Well, I think it was Drano? It was something. It was a rug.
I thought it was I thought it had the mobile sign on. I thought it was whatever. Regardless, it's poison, and it looks like whiskey, but it's poison. He pours himself a glass of that, and just as he's about to drink it to finally finish the job and just kill himself in his sanctuary, Amanda Seyfried comes in. Now, right. We see Amanda Seyfried in his house, which is right next to the church, as many priests' living quarters are. Amanda Seyfried just appears. Yes. There's a question as to what is happening in reality at this point, because Cedric the Entertainer tried entering his house from the outside, trying to check up on him because he was late to the church, and he couldn't get in. The door was locked.
Correct.
So we had this, in one scene, this bloody, covered in barbed wire Ethan
Hawke
character.
And it's showing through his robe.
Bleeding through his
robe. Disgusting.
About to drink this motor oil, this poison, whatever.
Amanda Seyfried. Yeah, some kind of cleaning product there.
You're not going to let this go, are you?
I wrote it down somewhere. I couldn't find it. I thought it was Drano, because he was cleaning the toilets earlier in the movie with Drano.
It could be, yeah. Amanda Seyfried just shows up. No knocking, no door opening, no nothing. And when she shows up, he goes to her. They make out. There's no blood on him during this scene. So.
Yeah. Obviously, if he was still covered in barbed wire,
he wouldn't her hugging hold her that
and
close.
She's hugging and kissing yep. him. Either she would feel it and freak out, mm-hmm. or he would wince like he was a panting lunatic and not be able to have this embrace with the panning, swirling.
Yeah, this very Jim cinematic Jarmusch, shot.
Yeah, Jim Jarmusch shot with the camera yeah. there spinning.
And then they played Journey's Don't Stop Believing, and the screen goes to black as Tony Soprano looks up from this.
No, but yeah, like kind of the same thing there. Earlier in the film, when he's journaling after the Ettinger Michael suicide there, he says, I wonder what he thought about before the bullet. I wonder what his last thought was. Was it this? Was it that? To me, that's how it connects. And both of us kind of, I guess, to focus on the ending now, because I got two theories. And Paul Schrader basically said in many of the interviews that he wanted you to think there was enough evidence stacked up in either direction where you could take some ambiguity out of the final scene and go either way with it. He killed himself, he drank the Drano or whatever was in there, the motor oil, or this really happened. Now, we believe you cannot have the barbed wire scene and the kissing scene. Those can't be true in any reality nope. of the movie, and never mind in real reality. So you can't have those two scenes. One of those scenes was imagined. Now, there's a established unreality to this movie with that soul gaze, that magical mystery tour.
Yes.
Number one. So we get his last supper at the sushi place with Balk in attendance. I mean, he's stalking Balk.
Yes.
You know, essentially.
And why do we deprive ourselves? That's when that
Why do we deprive ourselves of those simple pleasures? We get the bike ride with Amanda Seyfried. It's clear that he is
given into his feelings for her.
Yes, he is attracted to her. They have the intimacy of the soul gaze, et cetera, et cetera. He frees himself romantically after White Fanging his previous kind of girlfriend, lover, friend.
Mm-hmm.
Makes us believe, essentially, and of course the big romantic gesture of not blowing the whole place up because she's there.
Right.
And you think that he could potentially have this pathos or catharsis where he realizes that she's what he needs. He needs to be, you know, that's kind of the longing of it.
Right.
And it's very sad at the end of the day.
It is.
So you can buy that. Again, Schrader stacks evidence towards that conclusion. Like I said, throughout.
The smoking gun of it all, though, is the Cedric the Entertainer not being able to enter his house.
Right.
Because he is locked out, and it's such a simple scene, and you think it serves basically no purpose. When he's covering himself in barbed wire, he's locked out, and then she just appears. And so the implication of that alone is that obviously if a member of the church can't get into the house, how is this random woman going to come in without making any noise, especially when he's on the verge of literally committing suicide?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident that the fact that they showed the scene earlier with the barbed wire, the fact that they, the ominous omen of a dead animal like that, a little rabbit, the pouring the Drano in the glass,
yep.
I did write down Drano, by the way. So these things don't jive with the theory that the kiss is the end of the movie's reality.
Yeah,
the kiss is the end of his delusion.
The reality of this movie has been so heavily based in audacity Like, you see the headless body of Michael after he pulls the trigger and kills himself.
Yes.
You see the reality of Ethan Hawke covering himself in barbed wire and that shot of him bloody all over his torso, bleeding through. I mean, those are the shots of reality. The romance and the happily ever after, that spinning shot at the end.
That's a triumphant shot,
yes,
correct?
Exactly.
Based on their relationship and the abuse that is so clearly there in the relationship. And I don't think Schrader's shying away from that.
No.
I think he's saying something very pointed critique against the church there, Michael. I think it would be totally disingenuous to have a triumphant finish to a man who's abusing a woman in that final scene. Essentially abusing her in the sense that the power dynamic in their relationship is totally fucked up for them to have a sexual or romantic
relationship. I totally agree. And the thin line
So that's
he
not
walks.
A triumph.
No, yeah. the thin line he walks between, if there was a scene at the very end where she knocks on his door and he opens it and then that kissing scene happens, I think we'd be furious. Because this movie wasn't made to end on that triumphant note. It needed to have this either this ambiguous or this disingenuous ending.
These are the notes and these are the delusions of a very twisted mind, of a mentally ill person. And I think that it is the projection of somebody hoping and longing for something that should never be, and it's wrong, in my opinion.
Do you think he's mentally ill, or do you think he's...
Yeah, I think he commits suicide. I think he's depressed, he's traumatized by his past.
Okay, but as far as like schizophrenia or any mental label like that, or do you think it's that he's so angry at the lies that the church has fed him, that he bought as his salvation?
I think that that all feeds his paranoia. Yeah, I think that's... I don't know. I'm not a psychologist or a therapist, psychiatrist, so I don't know which illness this is. But there is, like you said, schizophrenia. His reality is distorted in those scenes. We're getting his POV. It is distorted. His paranoia is running wild like the previous character who committed suicide.
And yet
he's traumatized by that as well.
He's able to articulate so beautifully, and this is one of my best scenes, in the tete-a-tete between he and Cedric the Entertainer in Cedric's office. He's able to articulate so powerfully about, look, you see religion as this thing that, you know, we shouldn't get involved in anything. There should be a separation between church and state. If pollution wants to tear apart the earth, then that's God's will. Just let it happen. Where I interpret the Bible as saying God's will is to protect his greatest creation. Every insect, bug, landscape, it's his beautiful thing. And that's whatever side of that you fall on personally, so, just to see that butting of heads.
Another way to look at it, and I guess this would be fascinating to break these scenes down. You know, is this like a Lynchian thing where the way these characters are coming across through his POV, through his journaling, through his distorted gaze? Like Cedric the Entertainer's character, his preacher character, may not have said those things. And if he did, they're under duress. They're still wrong. A lot of characters are saying screwed up things that are wrong here. So yeah, for Cedric the Entertainer to say, what if this is God's will? You know, the flood destroyed the earth. God's destroyed his creation a few times already. I mean, Cedric the Entertainer doesn't realize the level of mental illness he's dealing with here. So he doesn't know he's ministering to a person on the brink of losing it. And it's very tragic. And it's enabling. And it's a perfect storm. And I think the whole point of this, to get into some final thoughts here, Michael, the whole point of this is a look at the spiral of a substance abuse, mentally ill person.
Yeah, but it's not just, I agree. I totally agree with that. But I also think there's more. I mean, the comments he's making, and this is why I say we had such different conclusions of it and why I think it's such a great script. The comments he's making about the people that use religion as a force for judgment, as a tool of judgment.
Opposite of Fred Rogers and Mr. Rogers.
Exact opposite of Mr. Rogers. How Mr. Rogers was a conservative, but he was very open and accepting of everyone. And there are people out there.
Think about the generations of monks who were in exile, lost their goddamn minds as hermits. Religion, the people are people. You're gonna have a whole spectrum. The people who want to focus on the garden, who want to focus on the despair and the depression, the people who are mentally ill at their core, and it can fester and go out of control through the worst portrayals and of the religion, because the religion is a human, as human as anything else. So the human,
right,
the human weakness can be just run just as rampant in a religion that should be all about grace and love and forgiveness and support.
Exactly. And you can't be full of grace, love, forgiveness, and support and all those positive attributes that God preaches you need to have.
Right.
Even if you are a hardcore religious, you know, follower, if you are using you're using your religion as an excuse to judge someone or judge their actions or judge their character, or you're using it as a reason to get money or
just
exploit
look at
people.
His arguments to the kid, Michael, in that scene. It's just like, well, basically he comes up with a paradox, living with great despair and living with great hope at the same time.
A life without despair is a life without hope. Holding these two ideals in our head is life itself.
Yeah, all these paradoxes. And that's the whole problem with religion, trying to become so certain about everything.
Right.
And everything is uncertain.
Exactly.
And there's paradoxical truths out there. And for them to just be so, because it's so dualistic, so good and evil, it's so simplistic in that regard, then basically your mind is going in those two different directions that it doesn't work. The system of logic of it all doesn't work. And the kid sees right through that. The kid, he's 33 in this scene.
Right. Right. No, I think I absolutely agree. I think it's amazing what he was able to pass comment on all these different things in this very layered script. And to me, this did for what I call, you know, religious fraud. People who think they're living by the book, but really just use it as a means of saying they're holier than thou. I think this did for religious fraud what Get Out did for that elite liberal racism. I just think it's such a powerful subtext.
It is a harsh criticism of religion and the dogma there. It is a eye-opening and horrifically sad investigation of mental illness and substance abuse. And it is a character study of the perfect storm, you know, involved in a man that has a very tragic arc. And it's just very sad. And I think that makes it a strong story, but it's, again, perilous. And I would say the Gandalf quote again here, you know, and it's perilous to study too deeply into the arts of the enemy at times. It's not wrong, and it's necessary, but dwelling on a story like this can be disturbing, and for many of us and for many of you. So definitely beware and proceed with caution with a movie kind of like this.
Yeah, what do you have for us? Do final grades here to wrap up with?
It wasn't even on the radar of a good grade when I seen it the first time. I was just in disgust, but I do think it is a B+88. It's a strong grade for me. The script is undeniably well written. The subject matter is something that really pushes people away, but that's not a fair criticism, again, to say the subject matter should do so. It's vegetables. It's maybe poisonous vegetables for many of us, and I don't say that as a joke. I say that as true. I mean, this is a disturbing film, and this one can get under your skin. And again, if you have any issues with depression or mental illness or whatever, I probably stay away from this movie and again seek help.
Yeah, seek professional. There's no shame in asking for help. I'm probably a little lower than that. I'm probably an 85, reserving the right to obsess about this more, having only taken it in the one time. But I do think the commentary that he is passing without really addressing it directly is truly fascinating, and it's only can be done by someone who has experience and is used to presenting films in the ways that Schrader does here. The talent that's on display from all the actors too is amazing, but I'll be an 85 hard B. I don't think it's award worthy in anything maybe other than original screenplay. I wouldn't be offended by that. I wouldn't be shocked by that. But
we still have that 3-point curve.
Yeah,
it's like I'm always 3 points above you, or it's so weird.
Well, you like people.
It's a curve.
Guys. So this is a heavy movie. It was a heavy OSP, but we got through it. Apologies for not having direct, you know, best scene, worst scene. We kind of wove those through, but this was more about the ideals and the idealistic of what we're dealing with in the subject matter rather than the scene for scene takes themselves. So if you have any comments on that, you want to tell us what your best and worst scenes are, what you took away from this script, or if you drew a different conclusion, let us know. Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram, MM and Oscar on the Twitter machine, Mike and Oscar.com, at gmail.com on Reddit. TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, Google Play, we're everywhere that you see any kind of podcast, and we will be reading the winners of the 6 degrees of NMO later on this week for round three, connecting not Sidney Poitier. We did that already. What's this one?
George C. Scott to Michelle Yeoh.
Yes, of course. That famous pairing that have been in multiple films together. We're going to give a shout out, free plug to that. So if you're your own podcast, your own website, your own standalone human being, you want to get your name read and your theory, your submission talked
fans
about.
Fans and friends welcome. Yes.
Your submission talked about by us. We'll bat it around.
Twilm Fitter or Film Twitter. They are welcome. Thank you.
All right, guys. Otherwise, reality sucks. Keep watching movies with us. Mike, any final words of wisdom here?
I follow Gandalf.
Fair enough. We'll see you guys next time.
See ya. Heaven must be just like this.